Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And welcome to another fun-filled episode of the M Squared TechCast. I am informed that this is episode 97.
Yeah, how about that?
We are inching ever closer to the century mark. We'll have to do something really special for the 100th episode.
Well, yeah, that's only three episodes away. We'll have to figure out something there.
God forbid we should plan anything. You know, I mean, that's I didn't do everything on the seat of my pants, you know.
Yeah. So. Anyway, we have with us Mike Casewell, the founder and CEO of Roasting Plant.
Now, you might not think of coffee as being high-tech. Au contraire, according to Mr. Casewell.
Yes. Well, why don't you tell us how high-tech your coffee is, Mike? I guess that's one of your claims to fame, right?
Yeah, absolutely it is. Roasting Plant's really a third-wave coffee specialty retailer, which essentially means that we place a large degree of importance on coffee quality, coffee sourcing, and coffee variety. But unlike the rest of the third wave, we've chosen to use technology to enable our customer experience. We call this technology JavaBot, and it's important, at least to us, to note that JavaBot is not really retail shtick. It's actually how we do what we do. So when you come into a roasting plant, you've really walked into the middle of a giant automated just-in-time coffee machine that produces best-in-class cups of coffee right in front of your eyes from unroasted beans. It's our patented JavaBot, which enables us to serve coffee that's just roasted, just brewed, and just for you.
Okay, that's the part when you said unroasted beans, I was thinking, oh my God, green beans? So it just does it all at once then. That's your secret, the secret sauce, as it were.
Yeah, we really shrunk almost the entire supply chain for a cup of coffee right down into the store. So we start with unroasted coffee.
Huh. Okay. And apparently you are expanding rapidly. I'm told you've just come into Ann Arbor, where I live. So where's that location?
Yeah, go blue, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We are on State Street, right across from the Diag.
Oh.
And we're very excited about that.
Prime location, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, student section
yeah.
there. So,
yep. But, we also recently opened on Ford Road in Dearborn Heights. We're at Minneapolis International Airport. We're at Denver International Airport. Hmm. And in about a week, we'll be in San Francisco at the International Airport.
Wow.
Well, we got to get you to go into Seattle. I live 7 years in Seattle, and you can go heads up with Starbucks there, right?
Yeah, they know just a little bit about coffee in that town, I think.
Yeah.
So.
They do. I actually lived in Seattle myself, where I work for Starbucks.
Yeah, so. A trivia note about that Dearborn Heights location, that stretch of Ford Road there, I used to live in Dearborn Heights, and I think there are more donut shops per square mile in that area than there are any place else on planet Earth, and I don't know why. But that makes it a great location for a coffee place as well.
Yeah, well, you got to have the coffee with
the
donuts,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the police,
yeah.
Otherwise, what are they going to do, right?
Yeah.
So... Anyway, so let's talk about Starbucks. We both are, I'm not a Seattleite, but I lived there for 7 years, lived in downtown, lived in Edmonds. You were at Starbucks, and what was happening there?
Well, at Starbucks, I actually led a team that was responsible for analyzing their business processes and operations. So that's kind of really where I learned almost everything I know about coffee. But one of the most important things I learned was that it's a centuries-old business model that they're actually implementing, which as an engineer was kind of frustrating for me.
Okay. And so the backstory is you worked there and what saw a better way and decided to go with a roasting plant?
I was just always aware that if you ever had the luxury or the opportunity to start with a clean sheet of paper and design a new process that you would. And eventually I left Starbucks and I found myself with the chance to do just that. I set about designing the ultimate bean to cup process. And really at Roasting Plant, that's what we're doing. We're simply using modern automated manufacturing technology to make a cup of coffee. We're just doing it in a consumer setting and we're doing it right in front of your eyes.
All right. So essentially you're using supply chain management technology, it sounds like, in order to make the time between the roasting of the bean and the making of the coffee as short as possible. That's what it sounds like anyway.
Exactly. I mean, essentially what we've really done is just eliminated large parts of the typical supply chain. So we roast in store, in every store, and we transform that freshly roasted coffee into a coffee beverage without ever packaging it, processing it in other ways, having to distribute it. It's all done on site.
So how do you know how much of each specific type of coffee to roast at a particular store? Is that something in the software that analyzes that and predicts it, or how does that work?
We can use the software to predict that, but we actually find that the employees in the store really enjoy taking control. So we let them do it. And they get very good at understanding what their customers love and when they're going to need it. So we actually find that everybody's happier if they're more in control of JavaBot as opposed to less.
Hmm. And so do you roast every day, or how do you do that?
We do. We roast in micro batches, anywhere from 3 to 6 pounds at a time. We're roasting kind of continuously throughout the day and throughout the week, so that when customers order a cup of coffee, they choose the bean that they prefer, and that cup of coffee is going to get ground and brewed for them in about a minute, and it's going to be made from coffee that was probably roasted about 12 to 24 hours ago.
And some of those flavors are, or beans are, what are they? What's the best-selling one, by the way?
Well, our roasting plant blend is the best-selling one, and that's a proprietary combination of coffees from all around the world. But we sell coffees from Costa Rica and Brazil and Sumatra and Kenya and Ethiopia, Jamaica, Hawaii, you name it. Any region that is growing premium quality coffee, we will offer it at one point or another.
Huh. So you're like Colonel Sanders. You got your secret recipe. You're not gonna share that with the audience right now, are you?
No. Why would they come in if I told them how to do it?
I had my pen all poised. I was ready to write that down, too. So, good.
So do you have some kind of consumer app that people can put on a smart device to order in advance or anything like that? Have you gone that route?
We have been testing some technology. We love to develop our stuff from the ground up. I'm an engineer at heart, so we have been sort of exploring that possibility, and I think that probably within the next year or so we will.
All right. Yeah, you mentioned in your background material here that you are an industrial engineer. Is that what you're? Do you have a degree in that? Did you study that in school?
I did. I went to another U of M. I went to the University of Massachusetts, and I studied industrial engineering and operations research.
Ah, okay. Well, we have a very active IEOM chapter at my employer, Lawrence Technological University, so I am actually familiar with what that is and how that could apply here. That's a pretty interesting application of that field.
So,
yeah, I never would have thought I'd be doing it in coffee.
Yeah.
But here I am.
Yep.
So before your life in coffee, what did you do previous?
I worked in high tech and in manufacturing. I worked in management consulting for electronic data systems at one point and had various jobs along the way in the computer manufacturing world.
Ah, okay. So what's next? Besides this rapid expansion going all over the place, should I ask, is this all self-funded, or do you have private equity finance involved, or what's going on with that?
We do. You know, we've invested a tremendous amount in the development of this technology. So we do have private equity backing. From here, you know, we're just excited and working really hard to begin bringing the roasting plant experience to as many people as we can.
How did you get the idea of locating in airports?
That idea came to us. Really, you know, we got approached by one of the sort of better but small airport operators. They had been to downtown Detroit and experienced Roasting Plant in that store, and they approached us with the idea that it would be a big hit in the airport setting.
So you're
and we've done very well there, yeah.
All right, so you were educated in Massachusetts. Are you from there originally, or are you from Michigan originally?
I am from Massachusetts.
Okay. How did you happen to locate in Detroit then?
We got approached by Dan Gilbert's organization.
Ah.
I think early on when he was sort of in the beginning stages of the redevelopment push, he was looking for the most interesting retail and services that I think he could offer to prospective employers and employees for downtown.
So that
he discovered us in New York and asked us if we'd be interested in coming to Detroit.
Might one then extrapolate and say that one of your investors is Dan Gilbert?
No.
Ah, okay.
He is not. He was very instrumental in bringing us to Detroit, and that has been really a wonderful experience for us. But he is not one of the company's investors.
Are you at liberty to say who your investors are? Are there venture funds that we might have heard of, or...?
Probably not. We have actually a couple foreign investor funds and then some U.S. Individual investors.
Okay.
So speaking of foreign, then I assume you're going to take this international, or at least that's the game plan, yes?
Eventually. We've had a tremendous amount of interest in bringing the experience to other markets around the world. So although we're focused primarily on the U.S. right now, I'm confident that at some point in the next couple of years, you'll see us popping up in some interesting key global cities.
Okay, so if people want more information about Roasting Plant, what's the website?
Roastingplant.com.
Okay, that's straightforward.
Simple.
And I have to. And where is your your physical headquarters located?
We are in Manhattan, so we are out of New York City.
Okay. All right. And more expansion coming in Michigan and elsewhere, I would imagine.
Correct. More expansion coming in Michigan and some other interesting cities in the U.S. are up next.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing with us here today. Mike Casewell, founder and CEO of The Roasting Plant, and that's roastingplant.com. Check out those locations in downtown Detroit and elsewhere around the metro area.
Including Ann Arbor, yes.
Yeah, and elsewhere. All right, for right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M-Squared TechCast. We'll be right back.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And you're listening to M-Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. We're actually waiting for Keith Brophy, the state director of the Michigan Small Business and Development Center, to join us. But we and I must admit, this changed several times. So I know we have the interviewee on the phone. Oh, do we have a? Is he here now?
We have Keith.
Keith, are you there?
Matt McCauley with Networks Northwest is on the line.
Okay.
Oh, okay, is Keith Brophy here?
And this is Keith. This is
Keith.
Hey,
okay.
Here we go.
Okay,
we'll
good.
We'll fix all that in post. Don't worry about it.
Sorry. Yes, we've had some technical difficulties. Been trying to dial in for a little bit here.
Okay.
All right.
Well, anyway,
your phone was not picking up.
Okay, let's start again. We have our regular segment now with Keith Brophy, who is director of the Michigan Small Business Development Centers, a fine institution helping small business throughout the state of Michigan at various locations, based in Grand Grand Rapids, and he regularly brings in businesses being helped by the Michigan Small Business Development Center. So, Keith, why don't you introduce your guest here today, and we can get the interview rolling.
Great. Thanks, guys. And I have with us today Matt McCauley, the Chief Operating Officer of Networks Northwest. And Matt, in addition to describing a bit about the good work of Networks Northwest for his region and our state, is also going to describe a very interesting event coming up on December 5th called the Business and Talent Summit, the Impacts of Technology on All Sectors. So welcome, Matt.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Matt, I mentioned the event, but could you describe this event that's occurring in December 5th in Traverse City? What's it all about? What time is it? What kind of crowd are you hoping to draw? And is it a statewide event or a regional event?
Yeah, so the event on December 5th being held in Traverse City, it's at the Hagerty Center, which is part of the Northwestern Michigan College campus right here in Traverse City. But the idea is to provide a convening of the entire state. It's not unique just to our region. And to offer a conversation around business, economic development, and education that are dealing with the effects of technology on their respective sectors. And what we know, and I'm sure each of you know and all the listeners know, that there is not an industry sector that is immune to the evolution of technology and how technology is influencing how we do business in Michigan, in the country, and globally.
So do you anticipate that your attendees for this event will primarily be local, or are you hoping to draw from Detroit and Grand Rapids and,
the Upper Peninsula? Yeah, we're absolutely hoping to provide a platform for a statewide conversation. We believe that Michigan has many different regions within it, and this is an issue area that is not unique to one region or another. And in fact, our regions are interdependent on one another. And then how and technology in and of itself really solidifies and reinforces that concept of the interdependency of regions within the state of Michigan and the interdependency of businesses throughout Michigan. So it was important to us when we designed this this convening, this summit, that it's not just a Traverse City thing, not just a Northern Michigan thing.
And what was the motivation for the event?
The motivation has really been from the business community itself, that the business community, and not specific to one industry or another, continues to evolve and in a proactive way and a reactive way to technology and its influences. That can be anywhere from traditional tech sectors, when we look at coding, when we look at automation, that type of thing, all the way to things in retail, in agriculture. Technology, disruptive technology, affects all industries, all sectors, and all regions within the state. And I don't think to date it really has been offered up in a broad brushstroke such as that. It's been technology is always spoken about and spoken to, but usually it's within a specific sector or a specific industry and not necessarily as a community conversation of how it can impact a community, a region, a state in a holistic way.
So I'm curious if you would rather have the doubters or the believers there, and let me explain. Often as I talk to small businesses about the transformations ahead and some of the predictions about workforce transformation and the impact of automation and the various technologies coming at us, I get the response that there's not really going to be any substantial impact. You know, that kind of massive change is a decade or 15 years down the road. Sometimes I find small business that already is starting to kind of shift gears and recalibrate how they march into the future, because they're anticipating a pretty quick transformation. What do you see as the pace of transformation, and who do you hope to have in the audience, those that already believe or those that are still a little bit skeptical?
Well, for me, the truth is always in the middle, and I think to have a mix of doubters and believers makes a lot of sense. You know, the difficult thing is technology is a pretty broad subject area, yet it impacts every singular industry and sector that's out there. So transformative change as it relates to technology may be quicker in one industry sector than versus the other, or even subsectors within an industry. The bottom line is we are not at a point in history, and we haven't been at a point in history for many, many decades now, where you can stick your head in the sand and think that when you remove your head from the sand 5 years from now, that it's all going to be the same. When we look at companies like Uber, Chompler, Google, all of these well-known industry leaders and transformative companies, how many of those were part of our lexicon 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Very few, if any. The world is moving very fast, and it affects every sector of our economy. And we're encouraging businesses in our region, and I would encourage businesses throughout the state and the nation, even if you don't think that it's affecting you, to at least be aware of the environment that's affecting your customers, if nothing else. If you really truly believe that there won't be a transformative change as it relates to your company, your business, that's fine. Definitely, everyone should know that transformative change is occurring elsewhere, and many of those are real and potential customers.
Now, I've heard some buzz about, a little bit of buzz about your emerging agenda, and that you're going to have a very engaging keynote speaker and other speakers and panelists as well. Can you share anything yet about the speakers at the event, or is it too early for that?
A little early. We have some folks from Automation Alley that are expected to be part. We have some people who are leaders with TC NewTek, which is a burgeoning technology group here in Northern Michigan. We have some people from the MEDC, leadership at the MEDC, that's confirmed. Again, looking at a statewide audience, a statewide impact, the speakers and the panels will represent the entire state and not just Northern Michigan, as would be appropriate, because we know that technology as a whole, and whether we call it transformative technology or disruptive technologies, are happening in every corner of the state. And our goal is to the best of our ability and what we can fit within a day, is find a good sampling of leadership within those emerging technologies, and provide the opportunity for our audience to hear from them directly.
Many of the forecasts about the impact of artificial intelligence and big data and sensors, you know, drones, autonomous vehicles, the comeback to workforce. And there's, you know, some predictions that as many as 80% of all roles will dramatically shift or be disrupted, some even disappear in the, you know, the 5 years, 10 years ahead. How do you think the region will do if it faces that kind of workforce transformation? You know, does the region stand ready to go through that kind of a adjustment in workforce roles?
I think so, and I think as a state we need to be ready. And what has been really enlightening to me is hearing from leadership within our educational institutions, whether those be K-12 or post-secondary, And for them to acknowledge that the students of today, that focus on skill sets rather than jobs, because a job that may exist today may not exist 5, 10, 15 years from now. So a shift in approach with our workforce to focus on skill sets that are transferable to existing, not only existing technologies and existing occupations, but future technologies and future occupations that simply aren't identified yet.
Where can the listeners that are hearing about this event today go to keep posted on it or to find out more information on it?
So right now, again, the event will be Tuesday, December 5th at the Hagerty Center in Traverse City. For more information and details as they become available in registration in the coming weeks, visit networksnorthwest.org, networksnorthwest, one word, .org.
So, Matt, this is Mike Brennan. So you're going to guarantee it's going to be great weather in Traverse City in December, right? Because otherwise folks from down south are going to be a bit hesitant to drive up there.
I'll tell you what, every single day of the year, the Bay is beautiful and should be viewed by all, even in December.
You're a politician, aren't you? I can tell.
Well, you can get around up there in the winter just fine.
Well,
you just
have to plan
ahead a little
Matt
bit.
Matt plans to retire in Traverse City.
Well, I started my career up there. I worked for the Leland Eye Enterprise and the Record Eagle from 1980 to 87. So that was a long time ago. But you get used to winter driving conditions. You just do. So
All the big storms happened between 1980 and 1987.
I haven't had one since.
Clear sailing in the early December days now.
I think he's in economic development up there, too. So,
yeah, Chamber of Commerce, whatever they call it. Right?
Yes, okay, that sounds good. All right, so when are you going to firm up the details on your event? Because we can steer people to it, but when do you think that'd be? Another 30 days?
Yeah, well, I would say in the next 2 weeks we'll have a detailed agenda and registration up.
Okay.
All right. All right, thanks very much, Keith Brophy, for another interesting segment. Are we
Where are we? We got a minute left?
Minute left, okay.
Okay, let's talk about what Keith does for a living. Go ahead, Keith, take it away. Talk about the Michigan Small Business Development Center.
The Michigan Small Business Development Center has a team of about 90 full and part-timers spread all across our state in 10 regions, and we provide no-cost guidance to help small business succeed. So areas such as business planning, market research, market strategy, financial preparation, and dialogues with bankers, investors, any of those broad range of needs, a small business can turn to their SBDC. And they only have to reach out to the do a Google on Michigan SBDC, and you'll find your way to your closest region or to the state center, and we'll direct you to your friendly SBDC counselor.
All right. And I know you guys help, about 10,000 businesses a year?
About 10,000 businesses a year, and we drive over $200 million of capital formation across our small business clients. So we're really making an impact with the small business community of Michigan. We work with everybody from startups to 100-year-old companies, and from solo entrepreneurs to microbreweries to agriculture to health tech and beyond. So if you're a small business with a need, feel free to reach out.
We're going to have to leave it at that. That was Keith Brophy, State Director of the Michigan Small Business Development Center, with his guest, Matt McCauley, Chief Operating Officer. I'm sorry, I'm looking at my notes as I'm leaning down. Chief Operating Officer of Networks Northwest. And this is Mike Brennan.
And this is Matt Rausch.
And you've been listening to M Squared TechCast.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M Squared Tech Cast.
And we have with us Nicole Pursuit, who she's been on the show, what, three, four times?
Four times, I think. Starting to add up.
Yeah, and so she runs a group called TechStack. Why don't you do the shameless pitch for what TechStack is?
Sure, thank you. So TechStack is an online platform that allows small businesses to be able to connect to technology providers. So we all know, and I think some of your other guests on the show already said, nobody's immune to the technologies that's needed. And TechStack is filling the gap of helping small businesses find the right technology providers for them and for their needs. That's a daunting process for small businesses. So we make the connections. We do the procurement, the sourcing, and make that connection for small businesses.
Okay. And speaking of which, this is my segue, you have Gavin Todd in studio. Chad Gaston?
Yep, Chad Gaston.
Calling in. And why don't you introduce them both, talk about what they do?
Yep. So not only do we want to connect small businesses to tech providers, but we also want to make sure that we're bringing tech expertise to small businesses. So we've got Chad Gaston. He is an independent consultant and an instructor, actually, in lifecycle marketing and digital product development. He's out of New York, and he's got 20-plus years in marketing. He also has worked for brands right in our backyard, like Ford and Dodge, as well as NBC News and then New York Times. We've got Gavin Todd, who is the co-founder and CEO of ShopWindow. And Gavin and his team, they have actually developed an intelligent customer experience platform, because we all know how important it is to engage with our customers as small businesses. So with that, we wanted to bring some expertise to the table today and talk to small businesses about how to engage their customers, customer experience, and using technology to do that. So, Chad, can you tell us just a little bit from your thoughts about the marketing stack? There's so many choices. How do you start engaging your customer through the customer journey? What tools are out there we should be using?
Yeah, great question. Top of mind for small business as well as any size businesses. I would say, first and foremost, you have to define what are your goals. Oftentimes for small businesses, that's about getting closer to the customer, using data. How can you better personalize and make your communications more relevant? As we all know, we like to get communications that are actually meaningful to us. And so there's a lot of tools out there right now. I would say, you look at like a HubSpot or Microsoft Dynamics, even Zoho CRM has a nice suite for small businesses. And then also customer journey mapping is very important, understanding the holistic customer journey and where your pain points are and in the moments of truth when you can, cross out, upsell your customers. And there's great lightweight tools out there like Smaply.
Yeah, those sound like some great tools. Some of them I've heard of, some of them I haven't. But if I wanted to do a customer journey mapping, where would I start? What could I start simply, to use?
Yeah, I think Smaply is a great lightweight tool. There's also another one called Uxpressia. And both of those tools allow you to almost create visualizations or drag and drop simple tools to be able to map out what your customer journey looks like from acquisition into engagement into all of your different promotions. And just so you have a very good understanding of, what you're sending out and what the cadence and frequency of your communications are.
Yeah, and I think about the marketing stack and what that means, and it goes beyond just your CRM or your your journey mapping software, or even, you know, simple tools that you can use, like even a PowerPoint. What else would you think of for a small business for a marketing stack?
Well, I absolutely agree that you are going to need several different solutions, and sometimes those can come in one stack, and then for some businesses it may make more sense from a cost perspective to use multiple free or low-cost services. Google Analytics is certainly a very powerful platform that can be used and has a lot of integration with other systems, and it continues to get better and better. So I recommend, you know, the Google Analytics tools. And then Adobe also has some that are suitable for small business, but in certain cases they may be more enterprise type of tools as well.
Yeah, and certainly for small businesses, we definitely want to focus in on the low cost, high value, at least to get started with. And then as we scale and grow, then we can think about the tools that can scale and grow with us. So Gavin, you know, as I think about it's just technology in general and what a small business has to cover on a day-to-day basis. You've got your website, you've got content you're trying to manage, you're trying to manage social media, you're using a customer relationship management tool. I'm a small business. How am I supposed to manage all of that? What am I supposed to do there to engage the customer?
I think you got to start very small. So when you're talking about collecting data, creating a customer experience, to start, accept the three rules. Number one, collecting data is wasting everyone's time if you don't actually use the data. Two, know how you're going to use the data before you collect the data. And three, don't waste anybody's time. So if we think of it as touch points, like what Chad's saying, inside the customer journey. And a touch point is every single place that your buyer interacts with your company, both online and offline. For a great customer experience, we need to enable all of our touch points with a data layer, a consistent message, and a next step. So we're training our buyers on how to buy. Let's look at how an online touch point works. So on your website, when someone goes on a particular page, they've been there 30 seconds, you capture that as a data point. You index it inside that person's data card, along with the title of the page or the page tag, thereby tying the level of interest and the interest to that person. Most businesses do nothing with this data, and about 50% even bother to collect it. Now, what's new and what's changing the game and how small businesses can compete with Amazon is your offline touch points, like your paper advertisement, someone walking into your store, or a phone call. These can be enabled with the data layer. So you can use technology to leverage your buyer's willingness to buy. For example, the Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Chamber of Commerce, who don't have a lot of resources, right now sent out an email postcard to non-member businesses in a recruitment campaign that is fully tech-enabled. The phone number has telephonic analytics so they can directly track the ROI. The RSVP is text the word chamber to a 313 number. Instantly, their confirmation. There's a question that asks which of the six categories they see as the most value they might get from the chamber. And when they submit that, the category they selected is the next thing they see. Now, that's an incredible way to use an offline channel, enable it with a data layer, and then package information specific to that individual on the fly right at the time of maximum interest.
That actually sounds amazing, but it also sounds a little bit complicated to me as well. So I'm thinking about your technology, Shop Window. Tell us a little bit more about what you've developed with Shop Window and engaging customers with the right content.
So again, it's really just starting very small. It's just what we've done is we've taken the 10 most engaging customer products out there, and then we've woven them into one simple, easy-to-use platform that's high-value, low-cost. So I would just say, you know, start manually. You don't even need to know technology. You know, there's so many options. Trying to work out what's right for you is overwhelming for a small business. So start manually. Work on your customer experience and then fit the software to the need. I can certainly give you an example of starting manually if you'd like.
Yeah, that actually is really good advice in terms of start manually and matching your actual need before you start to make purchasing decisions, right? Because you could make the wrong decision and spend a lot of money on tech you don't need, or at least that you're not maybe not ready for or even know how to use. So tell me a little bit more about what do you think about the most common fails of the customer experience and technology?
So we actually have, so the customer experience is every interaction, offline, online, that your buyers and your company have with your company and their perception of that experience. So we've partnered and we've done a lot of work with you guys over at TechStack, which has been really helpful. And we've identified the key failure points, the seven key failure points where consumer-facing businesses were not taking maximum advantage of potential customer interaction. And you can get this from TechStack. I know you're going to make it available. But, you know, one of them would be creating a permission moment, the moment that somebody interacts with your store offline or they walk in. You want to be able to create a permission moment so that that person is then wanting to receive specific information that's tailored to them as an individual.
Any other ones that come top of mind?
Absolutely. So, you know, you fail to network your content is number two in this resource. So, you know, organizations have tons of content, or they want to. They've got a website over here. They've got a brochure that they hand to somebody, a blog there, a video over there, PDFs, and they struggle. They want a simple way that they can package that information that's specific to that individual, do it on the fly, and deliver it to that individual in the modality that they choose.
I love it. I love it. It sounds easy to use. For the actual article, or the seven fails article, is and also the workbook, the marketing customer experience workbook that we've got available. You can be able to find that on, we've got ShopWindow, and it's .io, right? ShopWindow.io?
.io or .me. We're actually transferring the me to the io.
Okay. And then we've got our customer experience bundle and workbook that will be available on techstack.com as well. And it's techstack.com.
Okay.
And TechStack has a variety of technology companies for businesses to choose from in a variety of wide variety of fields, right? That's kind of what you do.
Yep, exactly. Making the connections for those businesses that you need a variety of technology, I mean, to support your infrastructure of your business, running that day to day, and then what we talked about today, the customer experience and the actual business and marketing technology, that's a whole nother stack on top of your infrastructure.
Okay. Well, it's interesting segments as usual, but unfortunately we are out of time in this segment. But I'd like to have Gavin take us out in a singing, because he was singing earlier during mic check.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah,
any requests?
Yeah, you just say, you've been listening to M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. Sing it.
Yeah, so you've been listening to
M Squared TechCast.
TechCast. Did-dum.
At the Podcast Detroit
at
Network.
Network.
All right.
I like it.
Kind of different, you know?
We'll be right back.
Foster Brown, eat your heart out. Mike Brennan, yes.
And this is Matt Rouse.
We'll be right back.
Maybe.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Roush.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with our final segment on today's M Squared TechCast, edition number 97.
It is. It's hard to believe, isn't it? We've been having so much fun for 2 years now.
Yes.
Speaking of fun, we have Michael Brady with us. Good segue there.
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
A partner in the Southfield office of Warner, Norcross, and Judd.
Because let's face it, nothing says fun like a dispute resolution attorney. Let me tell you.
There you go.
Okay. And here, Joe's listening, so we have to be good here.
Yeah.
So he is the chair of the firm's litigation and dispute resolution practice, as Matt said, as well as co-chair of the automotive industry group and class action group.
Ooh, that's,
so you,
that's
what do you do
stuff.
In your spare time?
That's
then?
Right. That's yeah. right. I practice law a little bit in my spare time.
Oh, okay. So, more importantly, well, from our point of view, is you were instrumental in launching the firm's autonomous and connected mobility team. I know that we're working right now with Warner, Norcross, and Judd to promote that, so everybody knows all about that. And so one of the things that we already have up on my website is a column that you wrote on these directed buy agreements, which are quite common in the auto industry. And until I got that column, I didn't even know what it was.
No.
You know, so I
hadn't heard of it either.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about that. So these are three-party agreements where an OEM directs its supplier to contract with a specific sub-supplier. Shotgun marriage kind of thing, huh?
Yeah, it's an arranged marriage, essentially. This is a unique aspect in the automotive world. The original equipment manufacturers, or OEMs, like the Fords and the GMs, they have what we call tier one suppliers,
right.
but they also have lower tiered suppliers who they like and they want to be part of their supply chain. So oftentimes they will tell a tier one supplier, we're going to do business with you, but we also want you to do business with these smaller component suppliers.
Huh.
So the question becomes, who are the suppliers contracting with? Are they contracting with the OEM? Are they contracting just with the supplier ahead of them in the tier? And what happens when things go wrong? Who's responsible for what? And it's something that doesn't always get worked out in the automotive industry. And what we've seen in terms of tech companies coming into the automotive industry, they're not used to these direct supplier arrangements.
Well, kind of like me. I've been covering tech for 38 years, and I've never heard of these arrangements. And I would be quite uncomfortable getting a big contract and then having them say, and here's who you're going to work with.
Exactly.
All sorts of issues can arise, right?
Exactly. You might be told as a tier one supplier, if in order to get this business, you have to do business with a tier two supplier that you don't even know. You don't know if they're financially sound. You don't know what kind of quality they have. You don't know if they can meet your delivery schedules, but to get the business from the big three or the BMWs and the Toyotas, you have to do a contract and do business with that lower tier supplier.
So what do you see as the potential problems that these agreements present?
Well, the first question is there an agreement? The OEM may tell you as a tier one, you have to do business with a tier two, and then the question is, if you're a tier two supplier, which many tech companies will be, who am I contracting with? Do I have a contract with the OEM or do I have a contract just with the tier one supplier? So what we tell our clients is, first of all, before you do any work, before you provide any prototype parts, figure out who are you contracting with? What are your responsibilities and rights? What are their responsibilities and rights? That's the key up front to just get everything out on the table.
Sounds like a minefield to me.
Trust but verify.
Yeah.
Right? That kind of thing.
Ronald Reagan had a lot of things that he said that was right, and that was one of them.
Yeah. Holy cow. So tech companies, they're going to, you know, they're obviously trying to work with the autos because, as Bill Gates said, what, 15, 20 years ago, cars are computers on four wheels.
Yeah,
and
just another node on the network,
that's,
I believe.
Certainly the case now.
Yep.
So Silicon Valley or whomever is going to be in for a big surprise, right, if they work with GM, Ford, or some of the other big boys.
That's right. I was just in August out in Silicon Valley speaking on this very topic to automotive suppliers, and I got a number of surprised looks of folks in the audience.
Like, what?
Yeah. What am I going to have? I have to do business with somebody that I don't know, that I don't like, that I may even in other areas compete with. But to get the business from a big tier one or an OEM like a Ford or a Chrysler, I have to do enter into this contract. So, it could be a minefield.
So why are the OEMs doing this? What's their thinking?
They've done
reasoning?
This for a long time, though, right?
Well, the OEMs do this because they may like a tier two or a tier three supplier. If they're let's say it's a supply chain with respect to seats.
Mm-hmm.
They may have a seat assembler as the tier one, but they know there's a tier three that the leather is always just right, and mm-hmm. that's who they want to do business with.
Gotcha.
So they'll tell their tier one, look, to get this business, you have to do a contract with this leather manufacturer. And the tier one may not even know who it is, may not know where they're located, may not like them, may have done business with them in the past, but to get the contract with the OEM, they have to do the deal.
Wow. But who's the real Corinthian leather, right? So, I'm sorry, long time ago,
nothing like current references there, Mike.
Okay, so how do you advise these folks in the tech industry? Because that's really what we're focused on here, is how are they going to deal with all this stuff?
Sure. So what the advice that we give our clients is before you enter into any undertaking of work, you need to understand, and the best way to understand who you're contracting with is to sit down with the OEM and your tier one supplier, if you're a tech company, if you're a tier two or a tier three, and set out from the outset, and this seems like common sense, but set out from the outset, what are my responsibilities? What are your responsibilities? Am I design responsible for what I'm going to be providing to you? What if there's a warranty problem? Who pays for that? If there's a warranty problem and I'm a tier three tech company, do I get to be part of the root cause analysis? Do I get to sit at the table and figure out what went wrong? Or are you just going to send me a bill to pay for all the recalls that you had to undertake? So before you enter in any contract, go through what we call, and this is not a new document, it's called a RASIC chart. That it's just what it says. It's a chart that sets out what are the responsibilities of each party. Who's responsible for some item? Who has approval for an item? Who is design responsible? Who's responsible for warranty costs? What happens if there's a design change? Who has to sign off on that? All those different things, in the ideal world, are set out as part of the contract. But even if you can't get it into your contract, at least you have a document that you've worked through, that you've checked the boxes on who's responsible for what. So, again, if it's not part of the contract, at least you have something you can point to 3 years down the road if there's a problem.
Hmm. These sound like they must be about 100-page contracts or something. I mean, there's all this minutia that you got to go over. Well, how do these typically play out? I mean, take a long time to negotiate?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. A tri-party agreement can be 3 or 4 pages. Hmm. It can be very straightforward. The problem, and I know a number of tech companies are struggling with this now, the problem with the OEMs is that they have pages and pages of terms and conditions, the fine print, if you will. And the question we sometimes get from startup companies is that really part of the contract? Well, it is going to be part of the contract unless you say it isn't. So it's better to spend a little bit of time up front negotiating a 3 or 4 or 5 page agreement as opposed to just hoping everything works out down the road.
And have big litigation on the other side, right?
Well, that's right. And that's a lot of what I do, is as you mentioned at the outset, is litigation. And I can tell you that an hour or two of having a professional, an attorney, look at something on the front end is much, much cheaper than having a litigator litigate a contract in court. What is the contract? Who's responsible for what? A lot of times in the automotive world, the parties don't even know what the contract is. I've had a number of instances where a client is sued, and I ask them, okay, there's a dispute under the contract. Send me the contract. And a number of suppliers, they don't know what the contract is.
Oh, God.
Is it a purchase order? Is it an invoice? Is it the terms and conditions? Is it a statement of work? So that becomes a real problem. So the more you prepare at the outset, the more you set out what is part of my responsibilities. Every tech company, every automotive supplier, they have an area of expertise, and they will stand behind their product. But what they can't do, what they won't do, is be an insurer for anything that goes wrong with the car. So as long as you spell that out on the front end, the better off you'll be down the road.
So one of the things that you noted in your packet here is that the automakers have slightly different approaches to these directed buy agreements. Let's talk about that for a bit. What are the various approaches of the automakers?
Sure. Well, Ford has a very complicated tri-party agreement that they don't always use. And when they do use it, it's very difficult to comply with. Mike, as you said, how long are these documents? Ford's is very long. It's very complex.
Yeah.
GM does not have a tri-party agreement. They just send what they call nomination letters to a tier one and a tier two saying, we've picked you. We've picked you, tier two.
Sort it out.
The problem with that approach and the problem we see is if a tier one and a tier two get in a dispute about something, typically the OEM's response is, work it out, guys. It's your supply deal. Work it out. What the tier one and the tier two suppliers need is the OEM to come in and say, guys, I'm going to help you work it out. And if you have a document that actually requires an OEM to do that, all the better. Chrysler actually just recently adopted what the original Equipment Supplier Association has put out as sort of a best practices tri-party agreement. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but Chrysler has taken a good step forward on that front. The foreign OEMs don't have any tri-party agreements.
Oh.
So the Japanese, the German companies, the others, so they just say, again, we're going to use you, we're going to use you, you guys work it out. So again, it's fraught with peril.
Wow. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, besides these directed buy agreements, is there other advice you can offer to technology companies entering the automotive space?
Well, I think one of the big issues that tech companies need to be mindful of is protecting their intellectual property. That oftentimes will be their biggest asset. So it's very important, again, at the outset, to protect your intellectual property, to make sure that you're not giving it away to an OEM or to another supplier. And again, a few hours of remedial measures on the front end from an attorney can help you basically protect your company.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about Warner Norcross and Judd and your various practice groups. And if folks listening to this want to reach out to you and all that jazz, how do they do that?
Well, they can find us at our website, WNJ.com, WNJ.com. Mm. And all of our information is there. We are a full-service firm. We have 8 offices in Michigan, clients throughout the state, throughout the country, and throughout the world. We are a general practices firm, so we have practice areas in essentially every legal topic that you can think of, from trust and estates to real estate to corporate to what I do, litigation. We also have industry groups, and our biggest industry group is automotive.
Hmm.
We have 70 attorneys in our automotive group.
Wow.
We meet on a monthly basis, and we go over issues, including a number of these issues that relate to tech companies coming into the automotive industry and how we can help our traditional auto suppliers as well as our tech clients. And in our auto group, we also have the autonomous vehicles group, which we're the leader on that in the industry. And we've been advising suppliers on how to address the connected and autonomous vehicles segment and how to deal with all the new legislation that's coming out almost on a daily basis.
All right. Well, we'll have to get you back on the show to talk about that. Take your and his guest column is on MI Tech News right now. But unfortunately, we are out of time.
Yes. And we want to thank Michael Brady, partner at Warner Norcross and Judd, for an interesting segment today. We want to thank all of our guests, Nicole Pasuit from TechStack and her two guests today, Keith Brophy from the Michigan Small Business and Technology Development Center. Oop, I'm sorry, they took the technology out of it, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
Michigan Small Business Development Center. You got to remember that. And also Mike Casewell, who kicked off the show, CEO of Roasting Plant, the interesting high-tech coffee roaster based out of New York but with a lot of operations in Michigan. So,
yes.
Fun show.
Fun, yes. And a couple more, we'll make 100, and then we start the Jessica cam,
yes,
right?
Indeed. That's Jessica's our engineer.
Yes.
And yes, we will have a Jessica cam at some point. I think she might just, you know, put up a cartoon drawing of herself in front of it, but right. You never know.
So, who knows?
Okay. All right.
All right.
But until next week, this is Matt Rouse.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast, and we are proudly part of the PodcastDetroit.com network.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.